as we tossed about this idea this morning, it was decided that perhaps the best thing to do is for me to address some questions to those people here who have had an opportunity to look at the world in deeper terms than most of us, and particularly the church in that way. But it will not, discussion is not limited to them, but I will address some questions to those people who have been part of the World Council of Churches Assembly. Each of them in a different way has shared hope with us. Those of us who heard them the other night already had a bit of that. And each of them has a special interest, I think. So although they are going to be limited in the amount of time they can talk, you're going to have to talk just a mile a minute, I think, we do want to try to get a glimpse of their worldview. And I expect that it's going to be more than optimistic. I expect it to be hopeful. If we think about a current world problem, seems I started from the same place last time, but that's just coincidental. When we think about the kinds of things that we hear all the time in the news, and the things that kind of weigh us down after a while, where we feel powerless, frustrated, the Middle East, certainly in the most recent years, comes to mind frequently. And I know that at times I think I'm virtually throwing up my hands, thinking, oh, it'll never end, never be done. Let's ask John Taylor to reflect on the idea of whether or not there's any hope for the church being part of the reconciliation of Middle Eastern difficulties and problems and differences.
Perhaps I should start just by reminding us of a few of the very depressing facts that really feature the church situation in the Middle East today. And that is a false warning. I say a depressing situation. Because when you ask about the role of Christians in the Middle East, I think most of you are aware that this is a part of the world where Christians are becoming fewer and fewer. If you look at the emigration statistics of people from the Middle East, you find that by far the largest group of people that are leaving the Middle East, whether it's from Egypt, whether it's from Lebanon, whether it's from Turkey, whether it's from Iraq, are Christians. Quite a number of them are finding their way to the United States.
John, I've just got to do this.
You want me to start again?
I will just sort of... We have forgotten to start on properly here on our forum for tonight, but we are discussing the possibilities of hope in the world and the kind of world conflict that we have. Beginning with John Taylor talking about the Middle East and whether or not the church can contribute to reconciliation.
I think we should be realistic when we expect the church to be doing something in the Middle East, because there is this very troublesome fact that Christians are becoming fewer and fewer within the area itself. Christians are leaving Egypt, Turkey, Iraq, Lebanon, and not least, leaving Palestine and leaving Jerusalem, the city where for us it all began, in the death and resurrection of Jesus. The overall mood of Christians in a situation like that might well be a mood of despair. And one of the humbling and one of the exciting things for me working these last 10 years with the World Council of Churches and having a particular staff responsibility for the Middle East is to find the way in which Christians, precisely in these embattled situations, and embattled in the most literal sense, gunfire every day, their houses blown up, their churches destroyed, in situations like this, there is still not only a will to survive, but an ability to hope, an ability to believe that somehow things will work together for good, for better. I don't want to romanticize the situation, because the very fact of the exodus and the emigration illustrates that for some people it is too much. There are these large numbers of people that are forced either by external forces or sometimes by a form of internal despair to leave the area. But the churches themselves have, precisely through these years of such difficult external circumstances, begun to show a whole new lease of life, in my observation. There has been, for example, the visible evidence of the Orthodox churches of both families, the Eastern and the Oriental, and the Protestant churches coming together in a regional council of churches. And a regional council of churches which shows signs of incorporating before too long also the Roman Catholics of the region. There's been a new sense of solidarity that's come to the Christians, precisely because of the difficulties that they face. Real difficulties are in mind. The Coptic Church, the largest church in the area, in the this whole region, has its patriarch in virtual house arrest at the moment, as a result of a sort of quarrel developed with President Sadat, a quarrel that was precipitated, let it be recalled, by expatriate Copts in America, who made all sorts of protests when Sadat came to Washington and painted a picture of Christians hostile to the government, critical to the government, and so on and so forth. The damage has been done, and yet the church, instead of just sitting there licking its wounds, is, in my observation, at least in its more responsible leadership, trying to come through. Lebanon, another example, where despite this dreadful civil war, which the journalists persist in describing as a Christian-Muslim civil war, has unleashed all sorts of forces for reconciliation, whereby Christians and Muslims, and those few Jews who remained in Lebanon, have been determined to show that here is a society that really can be a shared society. Of course, there are still many forces against them. There are many people who do misuse religion, Christians first among them. But despite that, there is, at least at the level of church leadership, in the church youth movements, in the ecumenical movements I know, an enormous ability to go on hoping and go on working, because it isn't just a theoretical thing, it's a commitment that people want to go on realizing forms of cooperation that go against all the current trends for fragmentation. And last, because I mustn't ramble on too long about this, even in that most intractable situation of all, in the Holy Land, in the Jerusalem over which Jesus wept, there is still, despite the hardened attitudes of governments, of official political parties, of liberation movements and so on, there is still a certain hoping against hope. There is a certain recognition that it is only as we start to dismantle the caricatures and the fears about each other that we can really move towards a solution. It's not by a unilateral declaration that Jerusalem belongs to one community that you're going to have a long-term solution of the problem. It's only as you can work towards a shared solution where all communities can have their own say, can have their own dignity, can have their own freedom of worship and so on, that you're going to have a hope for peace. And that's where I see even some of the lay movements, maybe Jewish lay movements, maybe Muslim lay movements or Christian lay movements, and also a few of the hierarchy, though not as many as I'd like to see, going against the trend, taking risks, taking the risk of meeting, because it's an extraordinary feeling to be in Jerusalem and to be saying with an Arab Christian, and to know that over the last 6 years he's never gone three blocks from, say, the Arab YMCA to the Hebrew YMCA, because of the barrier, not of a Mandelbaum gate that no longer exists, but because of the mental barrier that lies between peoples, even between Christians who live on one or other side of what is still, to all intents and purposes, a divided city. Very hard to hope in a situation like that, but indispensable to hope. And because people are going on hoping there, then I think the rest of us must dare to hope. But not a cheap hope, not just a sort of easy feeling that it's all going to come right somehow. It's a hope that has to take risks. It's a hope that has to suffer. It's a hope that has to face ridicule. It's a hope that has to be foolish if we are really going to dismantle some of these principalities and powers that can infect not only the political strata of our society, but even the spiritual, ecclesiastical, religious strata of our society.
Thank you, John. We promised John that when we leave, we will all carry him over to the jacuzzi. Like the cloudy past. Beside John is John Yoder. And I think because of his interest and our concern, we would want to know, is there hope for this world in regard to nuclear war?
The shape of the challenge is somewhat like what Montetter just been talking about, in that one doesn't find a solid basis for simple optimism, either religiously oriented or more widely based, as the way things are going. There are some indices of encouragement, but they aren't as deep as one would wish or as some people think they are. Whether we look at the World Council of Churches event itself, or at the last 3 to 5 years of development in Western Europe and North America, fortunately very little anywhere else in the world, there is clearly a movement of deepening concern rooted in the churches, but wider than the churches, identifying the nuclear arms race as hopeless, not capable with its own momentum of producing anything, certainly not the security it promises, as being not only questionable at the point of the immorality of ever using those weapons, but destructive even if they are not used in battle, because of the misallocation of resources, because of the maintenance of a psychic polarization in the world between our side and their side, and the restraints on freedom of discussion and flexibility of political change, which are imposed on a system when it's polarized between the two superpowers. Well-known German theologian who was also at Vancouver, Dorothee Söhle, has a book saying that nuclear war kills. It's not quite the title, but that's the point is that even without a war, nuclear armament is killing people by taking resources away from other uses, by the pollution and waste factors coming from the creation of radioactive waste and all the rest. That awareness is growing sufficiently that we can speak of a deep change of mood on the part of moral elites, and that includes church leadership. So it could not include the people that went to Vancouver. And people went to Vancouver made strong statements to the effect that it would be immoral ever to fight a nuclear war, and that it is therefore morally questionable to prepare for it or to threaten it, and that there is a moral imperative for finding new solutions to whatever the problems were that the nuclear race was supposed to be solving for the parties that thought that that was the solution. That moral pressure, however, is not nearly as deep or as promising as one would like to think. There are many church people that weren't in Vancouver that wouldn't have come up with the same clarity. There are many parts of the world in which these insights haven't yet won assent. There are many components of American society that don't see at all this reading of things. And then furthermore, some of the arguments that are used to make this case clear and convincing to some of us can be argued against. Since Helen Caldicott, whose presence was dramatic in Vancouver itself, and who has been one of the major public figures of the past 2 or 3 years in North America, bases her capacity to convince people on describing what would happen if they were where a bomb fell. Most of the ongoing thinking of most people still assumes that they'll be where a bomb won't fall. There is still the official doctrine according to which the first use of a few nuclear weapons will be on a small scale and the damage can be contained so that it will be possible to carry on a nuclear war. So that this growing insight is still a minority insight. It's not convincing to the people who aren't in on the movement. That's not just a tautology. It's the particular shape of the debate. And the reasons for the growing malaise are also partly selfish reasons and partly practical reasons. That is, if we could have a clean bomb, if we could kill the people without the fallout coming back on us and our children, then some of the arguments and some of the people who have become concerned maybe wouldn't be quite as strong. So the hope that we can have based in changing consciousness is only very modest. I don't think it's as substantial as the things in the life of a local church that John could point to in the Middle East. There is growing awareness. The numbers of people who doubt the doctrine behind the arms race is growing. The numbers of people who say that on specifically Christian grounds, there must be an oppositional movement is growing, especially in the Northwest, with James Douglas and John Nelson and Bishop Hunthausen. But that is still kind of shouting in the face of the storm. It is not yet anywhere near the kind of political effectiveness to turn the countries around or turn the superpowers around. So, I think this is an area where the grounds for hope have to be on another level than what we can see yet by way of signs of the time.
Do you have questions or comments?
I had understood that recently the polls that people were taking about people's perceptions of what nuclear war might mean, that those polls were indicating that people are beginning almost overwhelmingly to believe they will be where there is a bomb and they will die. Now, I can't quote you any figures, but it seems to me in the last year or two there's been kind of a trend.
I'm not good at social studies. I've seen some references of special selected populations. High school kids mostly don't think that they'll grow up to adulthood. Mm-hmm. That's been said about certain urban high school populations. I don't know whether to say that's a good news or bad news. That is, if people are more pessimistic about the shape of the world, does that increase the potential for a creative alternative to the extent to which that potential is based on realistic fear? It may. I don't think that changes the internal self-trusting confidence of the present Pentagon doctrine people, and I doubt that if we had a Democratic government instead of a Republican government, that it would change the minds of the people in the Pentagon radically right away either. It's the people on the other side still talk about strength. They still talk about a strong posture. They don't want to come off appeasing. So there will probably be a growing gap between the despair, fear dimension of the wider culture, which is growing, and the ability of anybody in social leadership to come up with other solutions. Unless some real Christian contribution to a new mentality breaks through that we haven't had yet. The Christian contribution has been to say no. And more people saying no, a few more people saying no dramatically. And that's itself backward, a step forward. But it still isn't a solution, it isn't peace.
It seems to me that is a sign of hope, if more people are afraid that they will die. Because in America, we are so comfortable, so complacent, and for so many years we have said it can't happen to us, and so we could sit back and we could go to PTA meetings and we could go to movies and ignore the whole problem. And it seems to me that the increase in personal fear is a good sign now, as opposed to alienation, which was the way the fear has been coming out for the last 20 years. What's coming out now is just outright fear. I'm afraid the bomb's going to drop on me and I'm going to die. And I think that it's coming out at a time when people in the church and in other faiths, for that matter, are able to present some signs of hope just at the moment that people reach their true fear. I won't say despair, I'll say fear. So that it may be that we're going from a stage of alienation to fear without having to let the process go on to despair. If the churches, the people in the churches, are saying, all right, you just noticed, now this is what you can do about it. You can trust, you can hope, you can be active. I think just the empowerment of doing anything would be an improvement, is an improvement, has been in my life and many lives I've known. Anything is better than sitting there trying to deny the problem. For me, the increase in personal fear really is a sign. It's kind of related to what John said about disarming the powers and principalities. I think that what's happening is the powers and principalities are getting a lot more obvious that in the nuclear arms race, that's what we're seeing, is the ultimate realization of evil, so that everybody has to recognize it. And I have hope that it's possible for people to respond.
I was just
going to
comment.
About the nuclear thing, this is what I'm going to say now. It's not my own opinion, but of many Latin Americans. They say, well, the First World and Soviet Union, they talk a lot about this. They do, finally, they are really having some fear, or they are only claiming to have some fear, we don't know. But we, in Central America, we are living the nuclear war. We are living it. We are dying each day. You are afraid to die someday. And we, and I said this morning also, I do not believe that we will have a nuclear war. And I do not believe this is not a question of alienation or super optimism, and Brazilians are perhaps more optimistic than Americans. But I don't believe in a nuclear war because of these wonderful signs of life that you have. You go to an assembly of the World Council of Churches representing quite heavy billion Christians. And one of the issues is confronting threats to peace and survival. Now, if you have such an assembly concerned about this, this means that a good part of mankind is concerned about this. And whenever you are concerned, I believe that we have, that this is spirituality, spiritual power, it's energy that goes from us. And this will change the world, and this will defeat the principalities and the powers, darkness.
Julie, could I just make one connection that I failed to make? I answered your question very much in terms of what Christians in the Middle East can do and are trying to do. But perhaps I should have made the connection to say that I think part of our duty as Christians who are living elsewhere is to try to feel much closer to those Christians who are in those embattled situations. And maybe that will eventually translate itself into a form of political lobbying in this country for a deeper understanding of the Palestinian cause, just as it should involve a deeper understanding of Zionism at its best. Now, I would say that in connection with the wider issue of the nuclear threat and so on, we shouldn't all the time be asking ourselves about how do we react if a Russian bomb is dropped on us. But I think we should also be asking the question, what does it feel like to be a Russian Christian, shall we say, with the expectation that an American bomb may be dropped on them, or a European bomb may be dropped on them. And it seems to me that only when we start trying to find solutions that are not just centered on our own personal role in this, but when we try to find ways through prayer maybe, but also perhaps through political contacts and political agitation, to appreciate how the other person feels about these things, but it's only then that we're going to start seeing things whole, and maybe have more grounds for hope. Because one of the extraordinary things that I have seen, others have seen, is that this pressure for peace coming from the churches is not just a phenomenon of the Western European or North American churches, but it is emphatically also a phenomenon of the Soviet churches, the Eastern European churches, the Asian churches, the African churches.
John, you're talking about the pressure for peace coming from the churches, and with special reference to the European churches. I'd like to get your insight, because I have felt frustrated in trying to understand the European churches. I see, living in a country that at least a lot of us are involved in churches, I see a pretty sterile situation looking from the outside when I look at the European church. Now, I know I see it wrong, but I don't know how it really is. Can you help me on that?
Well, certainly if one looks at the outside, or even the inside of a lot of European churches, it can be a depressing phenomenon. But the evidence, for example, of movements like the Kirchentag in Germany, again, one mustn't over-glamorize it and so on, but the phenomenon of tens and even hundreds of thousands of people coming together over short periods, and with a very particular focus on peace, is something that is not only spiritually significant, but also the politicians recognize has is political dynamite as well. What is happening in Britain, for example, with the movement of women in some of their sit-ins, in some of the nuclear establishments and so on, with a lot of leadership from Christian groups, is that the church is in some ways getting a new image in society. The church is not just seen as a somewhat aloof, antiseptic body on the sidelines, wringing its hands, but the church is seen through its laity, but also through its clergy, and even through its hierarchy, as pitching in to some of these difficult and even dangerous examples of
I think, legitimate in a free society political protest. I think for many young people, it's a sign of hope that a church they thought was outside their concerns and irrelevant to their concerns is finally being seen as a church that is relevant and is speaking to some of these deep anxieties which are traumatizing some of our own young people. So, with all the ambiguities of the church situation in Europe, one can't generalize it, recognizing that when it comes to the vote, for example, in the Church of England, we haven't had the clear leadership that we might like to have had. There have nevertheless been unexpected happenings. One of the most unexpected in Britain was during the Falklands, Malvinas War, when the church came out very strongly from top to bottom against the very jingoistic attitudes of our present government. And it was highly embarrassing and highly unpopular as a result. But I think it had to be done.
John, what about hope in terms of the third world? Arnold was touching on that, and I think we should pick up there.
Sort of 1 John, 2 John, 3 John. And you remember the next one will come next. Bob John Divine Private. But the letters get shorter as you go down. When you get to Revelation, then they're very long. Yeah. I think that I'd like to respond by raising the question of what do we mean by the third world? Because for many people, the third world refers to something over there, especially in the first world. And a lot of people now in the third world are very unhappy about the designation third world. You know, the first world is West European, North America, the second world is the Eastern Bloc, and the third world is Africa, Asia, and Latin America. It's a kind of third-class sort of status. And I think part of the mentality that needs to be changed in the world today is the mentality that divides the world in that kind of way. In other words, to really talk about hope for the so-called third world is impossible without talking about hope in relationship to the first world and the second world, because we are one world. And the more we talk about the third world, the more we see how integrally related it is in terms of its hopes and fears to what is happening in the first world. South Africa is a particularly interesting example of this, because within South Africa you have first and third worlds, if we can use those now not in terms of geography but in terms of what they actually point to. First world points to affluence and power, and third world points to poverty and weakness. Basically that's what they mean. You can see in South Africa first and third world coexisting. In other words, the third world is not over there and the first world over there, but first and third world coexist in one place. And I want to suggest that in North America you have the same thing. First and third world coexist. And that is where the real protest about designating the third world in the way that we normally do arises. We live in one world, and within that world, and within many situations within it, poverty and wealth coexist, power and weakness coexist. When we talk about hope in the third world, and hope particularly, and I speak here out of the South African experience, what grounds have we got for hope, and what signs are there of hope? Well, I think one is an awareness amongst Christians in other parts of the world of a solidarity with Christians and with people in places where there is a great deal of poverty, suffering and pain and weakness. I don't think it's nearly as sufficient, but there is that awareness. As I mentioned the other night, Desmond Tutu at Vancouver happened to say on one occasion in passing, and you know Desmond Tutu is a leader of black Christian liberation in South Africa, he said, isn't it an incredible miracle to have the sense of belonging to a world family with such solidarity and strengthening? And I think one of the signs of hope for the third world is the sheer fact of this Christian community that spans the continents, within which you do find solidarity, concern, and prayer. Desmond Tutu was asked at a press conference in Vancouver by some reporter who quite clearly was trying to get a political statement out of him. Now, what can the first world do to help you in South Africa in your struggle? He replied, well, you can pray, you know. If anybody else had said that, it would have sounded very cliche, very trite and so on, but he was pointing to something there that is very real. And that is, one of the signs of hope is when Christians begin to share in the hopes, the fears, the pains, the sorrows of people elsewhere. And in South Africa itself, I think a sign of hope is when white Christians begin to identify with the black struggle, and when black Christians extend forgiveness, grace, encouragement to white Christians. And not just a Christian. That, I think, is a sign of hope. When within the body there can be identification with suffering and weakness and forgiveness and grace being extended. And that's a very real thing. Many of us would not want to swap that for anything. That sense of the body of Christ that we heard about earlier tonight, that one experiences in that kind of situation, it's a very real hope. I think another sign of hope comes out of, and here again I'm talking about the African and particularly the Southern African situation, the incredible resilience of people. If you're black and in South Africa and you've been through and you've lived through the last 30, 40 years or even just the last 10, 15 years, even the last 10 years, the last 5 years, you have lived through a great deal of pain and anguish and fear. And yet the resilience of people, the capacity to handle that, the capacity to be able to somehow be on top of it and not allow it to destroy you. Now, that's not true universally, it's not true for everybody, a lot of people are casualties, but there are so many who are not. And when you worship within a black Christian context, you are lifted up by a sense of faith and hope in God, such as you very rarely find, I think, elsewhere. So a sign of hope is the human capacity, the God-given capacity, if you like, to surmount that kind of pain and suffering and discrimination that you find in the third world. You find this, I'm sure, amongst peasants in Latin America and all over the place. Of course, there is a level that can be reached when you do lose hope. It is the level where all that you really are struggling for is a piece of bread. And when you get to that stage, really, the world does become pretty hopeless. But I think that anything above that, where you do know that you are going to be able to survive physically, there's a tremendous capacity to hope and to live in hope. I think another sign of hope in South Africa arises out of the fact that there's a sense in which history is going somewhere. Now, if we as Christians lose the sense of God being somehow in control of history, not necessarily as a puppeteer controlling puppets in a fatalistic kind of way, but nevertheless that somehow God is active in history, that somehow purposes are being worked out, then I think if we lose that as Christians, I think we go down the drain, quite frankly. We've actually lost faith. But there's a tremendous sense in South Africa that history is actually not counter to the purposes of God, but integral to God's purposes. I remember one of the leaders within the church in South Africa saying on one occasion that he had had a dream. And in that dream, he had seen tremendous pain and suffering, but he had seen victory and reconciliation and shalom. He happened to be an Anglican bishop who had had that dream. We don't normally think of Anglican bishops having dreams of that sort. But I can share another dream experience, and dreams in Africa are very important. If you don't dream, then you're just not quite Christian, because you should dream and have visions. If you don't have dreams and have visions, then you're not quite in touch with what the Spirit is doing. I was addressing a meeting of a mission board in Grand Rapids some years ago, and there were two of us on the platform, myself and a black pastor from Natal, a pastor in our church. And I've been asked to give a presentation on the situation in South Africa, and I did my best to give a fairly rational, logical analysis of the political situation in South Africa, much as I will do tomorrow morning, that's a commercial. And I thought the American audience would appreciate that kind of handling of the whole thing. And when I sat down, this black pastor, who I know very well, got up, and he said, well, he didn't want to disagree with his colleague or anything, but he had a dream. And all of a sudden, all those Americans got on the edge of their chair. And I realized that what I had said had been forgotten immediately, and that what they were really interested in was his dream. And he said that he had a dream that on such and such a day, in such a year, and he quoted a day and a year about 10 years since, from that date, 1977, change would come about. Now, I don't know whether that dream will be fulfilled or not, but what I am saying is the sense that God is actually active in the situation. Yeah, I'm just going to finish. Yeah, the book of Revelation goes on and on and on. I'm sorry. But one of the best books written by a white South African congregational minister over 40 and under 45 in the last few years is The Church Struggle in South Africa. At the back of the last paragraph or two, there is a quotation from Alan Paton. I ran to fix this just now. Something triggered it off, I think, that John said, or one John said. I say to my fellow South Africans, if you have no hope, you should get out as soon as possible. If you have unbounded hope, you should go and see a psychiatrist. If you can't give up hope, if you insist on hoping against hope, then persist with all the things you have been doing to make this a better country.
Well, I have this bad part of the job of watching time. I don't want to end yet, but I know we need some limits, so perhaps we'll finish within 10 minutes. and try to have Dan contribute and Jean, and maybe we'll get back to you. I don't know. I'm not positive. Can you, Dan?
You have a particular question in mind?
Oh, I forgot. Are you hopeful then that Christians can develop a global consciousness?
Well, John was talking, I had a dream. I'm not optimistic, but I'm hopeful. In response to that, I would affirm a lot that has been said about a growing global consciousness among Christians around the world. And in the mood of what happened over in the evening worship service and the storytelling of East Africa and its traditions, I would just like to mention one incident and then two very quick stories, hopefully within, I'm not sure how long that will take exactly. One of them is a translation from the Russian. The incident is simply a comment that a young priest in Leningrad made about a year and a half ago at the last of quite a number of visits to the Soviet Union. And he got to know me over the years, and he said, when you go back to the United States to live now, he said, first of all, remember, we never want to have a war with you, to pick up what was said earlier. But immediately after that, he said, would you please ask the sisters and brothers in North America to pray for us? Because our lives depend upon that as Christians. I've never heard that request made over the many years of chasing around by people in North America, requesting that we would ask the Russians to pray for us. And that reminded me of two stories. It has to do with how a global awareness of the church functions and what it might mean. In the one story, it was written 130 years ago by one of the most brilliant of Russian writers, Vladimir Solovyov. And he buried this little story in the midst of a very difficult theological treatise. And it's an ancient folk tale that came from the north of Russia. And the translation from the Russian, if I could get it right, sounds like this. There was a hunter who became lost in the woods. And he walked up to a wide raging stream and sat down on the stump of a tree and laid down all the pelts that he had collected and laid down his gun beside him. And he sat on the stump of the tree and listened to a woodpecker tapping on the bark of a tree nearby. And he watched the wide, raging river rush by him. And he thought to himself, I'm lost. Life has no meaning. Things don't seem to be important to me anymore. I really have no reason to continue to live. And what good to me are these pelts and this weapon? And as he was sitting there in that mood, an old woman walked up behind him. The Russian reads, not just an old woman, but an ancient woman. Her skin was the color of an unpolished boot. And her robes were worn and tattered, regal robes, but worn and tattered through age. And she tapped the hunter on the shoulder and said, please, would you carry me across this raging river? Because I come from those parts, but I can't make it across there by myself. And he looked at the old woman and looked at the cold, raging river in front of him and denied the request and said, no, I won't carry you across. Again, she tapped him on the shoulder and pleaded and said, please, carry me across the river. I can't survive that trip by myself. And he denied the request again. Finally, she had a coughing spell and fell down on the ground. Looked as though she was about to die. And the hunter thought to himself and said, I can't let this old woman die. She must have borne a great deal in her day. I shall revere her grayness, and I shall carry her across that river. And then the translation reads, he said, well, all right, Granny, I'll carry you across the river, but pull your bones together, because if they fall apart out in there, we're lost. And he put her on his back, and it was as though someone had placed a coffin with a corpse in it on his back, and the weight nearly crushed into the ground. But as he stepped into the river, the weight became less and less and less. And as he arrived on the other side of the stream, he turned and found that there was not the old woman on his back, but a young maiden clinging to him. And the story ends, it was as though the entire world was new. And then Solovyov stops that story, and he goes back and said, the woodpecker, tapping on the bark of a tree, time mercilessly, marking moments lost, never to be retrieved again. And the river, obviously, the river, raging river of history, across which everyone must go or die. And of course, the old woman, the church, in her regal garment, that has the power to transform all of life, if we as Christians, good Russian theological assumption, if we Christians will carry her down through and around wherever she may have to be carried, including across the raging river. I think that that image of the church as a kind of common task is growing globally. And certainly the experience of Vancouver underlined that. And another story came to mind, and it's from a Russian also. In Pasternak's Dr. Chivago, there is an incident recorded about a trip across the steppes in a train, across the vast Russian steppes. And in the train car, full of people, no conversation was taking place, no contact, no interaction whatsoever, and all of a sudden the train stops. And people sit silently for a while and then begin to whisper to each other, asking what's going on, why the train stopped, and so on. Within a few minutes, conversation has begun, contact has been made, people are conversing openly. A little while later, a couple step off the train and try to find out what's going on. They recognize the train's not moving, and they all end up down on the grass having a picnic and eating each other's food and conversing and getting to know each other. And Pasternak ends that paragraph by saying, "And even the little flowers growing in the grass became terribly personal." My experience at Vancouver was something like a feeling that the ecumenical movement is a train. And once folks get onto that train and have a chance to realize how terribly personal the little ecumenical flowers are, it is a trip which cannot be turned back. There's no return on that one. And I could pick up, I guess, dozens of other instances from Southern Africa and elsewhere that would sort of undergird my conviction that there is a growing global awareness of the role and function of the church in the 20th century. And that's, for me, very fundamental and basic grounds for hope.
Jean didn't have, we decided not to ask Jean a question because she had a poem to share with us.
I'd like to claim that this is original, but it's not. It was written 1978 at a theological conference for many theological students in Europe. But I think the imagery is appropriate both in Vancouver and here, and certainly after the stories that we heard tonight. And I'd like to read the poem and then maybe offer a sentence or two of reflection of why I think it's important. For us, hope is not only something to drink, but also something to boil. If love, the beginning of theology, the beginning of our experience of God, is our drink in this place of mountains and lakes, then the story you hold in your eyes, we listened long before we spoke, is the fire of that drink of hope. This fire burns within me. Thank you. Hope is both drink and boiling energy. Let us boil in hope, boil and struggle with thirst until the God of all peoples is known and justice is realized. Let us drink from the wells within us as women and men. Let us drink with confidence, tears, and joy. We boil in the pain and passion of our oppressed sisters and brothers. We boil in the anguish of a God crucified, limited, imprisoned by our eyes, shut to love. My prayer is to boil with a larger vision and movement that I see in your eyes. Thank you for the gift of fire. I mentioned the other evening the importance of meeting one another at the Eucharist, and several references have been made to Desmond Tutu, who told us a story in his very short, I can't even call it a sermon, reading to us at the close of this last service. He told a story about a young man that was imprisoned in solitary confinement for 266 days, and how he could leave his prison cell. I mean, like I say, not bitter and not resentful. He entered that cell afraid and very much aware of his loneliness, but he said all of a sudden he knew he was not alone. He was surrounded by the sense of God and the prayers of the people that he knew were there. And I think for me, Vancouver, over and over again, people from the world were asking those of us in the North Atlantic nation whether or not we have the courage to go into solitary confinement, to live on the very, very boundaries of our culture, to engage in really creative alienation so that we are distinguishable from the culture, so that we don't look like every other person living in these nations. Do we have that kind of hope that will take us in radical opposition to possibly good friends, colleagues, other members in the church, our government, our little mini power principalities? Do we have that kind of hope that will sustain us in solitary confinement so that we can be still and know that I am God, so that we can really believe that there is a new heaven and a new earth? And I think that kind of hope that the people from the far corners of the earth brought with them to Vancouver and said, the gospel is central to our lives. Will it be central to yours? And if it is central to all of our lives, God really is a God of hope and a God of love.